Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Author Adrian McKenty's latest novel dives deeper into the troubles in 1990s Northern Ireland as he reflects on his time living in the decade that saw nearly 1,200 related murders. And he does so through his fictional creation of Sean Duffy. The latest entry in that mystery series is Hang On, St. Christopher. It brings us to July 1992, and the troubles are still grinding on after 25 apocalyptic years. Duffy is assigned to his most violent and dangerous case yet, and the future of the burgeoning peace process may depend on it. Adrian McKenty was born and grew up in Belfast, Northern Ireland. He studied philosophy at Oxford University before moving to Australia and then to New York. He is the author of more than a dozen crime novels, including the award-winning standalone thriller The Chain, as well as The Island. The new book is Hang On, St. Christopher, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Adrian McKenty to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. What a delight to have you on the program.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
I believe you and I spoke for both The Chain and for The Island. Those were the first novels I ever read by you. And then I learned about the Sean Duffy series and then just dove into that and fell in love with this character as well as your exceptional writing. I'm curious as to, given the success of those two books, The Chain and The Island, of what brought you back, or were you always going to go back to Sean Duffy?
No, it was the jokes. In The Chain, it's a very intense missing child story. So there's not a single joke in the entire book. It's 330 pages without a joke. On The Island, it was a story of a family on the run through Mel Gibson's apocalyptic style Mad Max Australia. And again, there's no jokes in the entire book. That's another like 350 pages. Whereas with the Duffy series, as you said in the introduction, it's the apocalypse. It's a nightmare. But the way people who got through the nightmare is by making each other laugh. And in all the Duffy series, there's lots and lots of jokes and humor and the humor of Belfast. And so I couldn't write another standalone without a joke. So I decided to go back and do two more of the Duffy books to get the jokes out of my system.
How difficult is it to, and it doesn't seem like it's difficult for you at all, but to be able to incorporate the jokes in the context of these very serious stories and with such frequency and also right through the end, though I would say the last 50, 60 pages of this book, while tense and startling, is also hilarious.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, no, it's not me. this isn't my like POV or worldview or whatever. It's just the people themselves. I mean, that's the way I remember it being. Like Belfast people are very, very funny. Just some cities are funny. Some people have a dark, like famously Boston has a very dark, sarcastic sense of humor. It's the same with Belfast. Belfast people are very, Dublin people are not funny. Dublin people in South Dublin, all they want to do is make money and buy clothes and talk about how their house prices have gone up in value. They're not very funny. North Dublin people, they're a little bit funnier.
Yeah.
But South Dublin people are just not funny at all. And there's just some cities that aren't funny. And, you know, Belfast is one of those cities. I'm trying to think like Liverpool, like Boston, like Philadelphia, where the people have got a dark, dark sense of humor. And I grew up in that world. I appreciate that. And all I've done is really reflect it like a mirror. I'm not that creative. I can't think of jokes but I'm not like Joseph Heller, who basically invented all this humor and put it into the situation. All I'm doing is kind of holding up a mirror to the way it really was.
I want to get to that in a moment because I find that element fascinating. But just that in reading this novel and others of yours in the series, that sort of playful of Belfast versus Dublin, which is in and of itself. I mean, yes, there's the troubles, but then there's also the realization that these are both big Irish cities and they're very different.
Yeah, I mean, when Duffy goes to Scotland during this period, or when he goes to Dublin, it's like really going to a different world, because Northern Ireland at this time is in the midst of basically, they call it the Troubles, and that's a strange euphemism that I've never really embraced. It was kind of like a low-level civil war going on for 25 years between the Protestants and Catholics, and with the hapless, idiotic Brits in the middle. Like, you know, it was just a nightmare situation. And then the people coping with that situation with humor and sarcasm and just the way Belfast people do. There are bits in the book where Duffy, you're right, he drives down to Dublin and it's a different universe. You know, Dublin, it's normal. And, you know, there's no war. There's no bomb sites. There's no army in the streets. And it's the same thing when he goes over to Scotland, where he's put his family for safekeeping, and he calls it shortbread land over there because, you know, people are going to hardware stores at the weekend and Walmart and B&Q and like buying barbecues and things. And it's this suburban nothing universe. And when he steps on the ferry and off back in Belfast, it's, oh my God, now I'm back into another world. It's like that bit. Do you remember that movie Hurt Locker?
Oh, sure.
My favorite scene in that entire movie is he comes back from Iraq and he's in the Kmart.
Yeah.
And he's just looking at these shelves full of breakfast cereals. And there's like this brightly lit UV light and he can't quite grasp it because he's not in the war anymore. And his life isn't in jeopardy and everything isn't on the line. He's just in this store under UV lights with 40 different types of breakfast cereal. And that's kind of what it's like when Duffy leaves Northern Ireland for Scotland or Dublin. He can't quite believe that this other universe exists.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that the peated scotch is the sort of the one through line between Belfast.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Well, and, he does Scotland.
Yeah, that's the thing that they've done very well for the last 500 years there, and I'm not knocking them for that.
Adrian McKinty is our guest. The name of the new book is Hang On, St. Christopher. It's a Sean Duffy novel. So I'm fascinated. You and I are almost exactly the same age. So I'm curious.
36?
Yes, that's right. We'll go with that. Fantastic. I love thinking about this, and I'm curious as to your perspective. You are writing this book as a character who is older, and I would say in this book that Sean is just kind of weary. He's getting ready to, you know, he's done. They put him in sort of a dead end to finish things up, and he's just sweeping the room before he heads out. And that is a character who has obviously seen a lot. And you're writing, I would presume, from your memories, which are that of a very young man, but also a child, really.
Yeah, exactly. Duffy is a 40-year-old man. And me, in that time period, I was a kid. So my experiences would have been very, very different from his. I mean, I would be riding my bike, you know, up into the center of Belfast, and Duffy is driving his cop car or his Beamer through Belfast as a 40-year-old man. So it's me adding 25 years onto what would have been my experience and putting myself in Duffy's shoes. There was one crazy metatextual moment in the third book where Duffy is in his Land Rover and they're driving at night fast through the countryside and they hit something. And they don't know what they've hit, but they keep going. And what they've hit is a child walking along by the side of the road. And that really happened to me in real life. I was actually hit by a police Land Rover and while I was walking along the road at night, and I was thrown into a fence and I'm quite badly hurt. And I was hit by the giant wing mirror of a Land Rover. They had these huge wing mirrors.
Yeah.
And I was hit by one. And I actually put myself as the child who was hit in the book with Duffy. And then I took myself out. because I thought that's just too bloody weird for is it's too meta that Duffy hits me as a child and I'm writing that story from Duffy's point of view, and I couldn't handle it. I wish I kept it in now just for the weirdness of it, but at the last moment, me and the editor decided to take me out. So yes, that's a good observation there, that I was living there as a child while I'm writing him now as a man.
The other thing you were talking about, the Beamer, and it just made me think about this. Every time you mention the Beamer in the novel, you talk about as Sean is getting into the car, he checks under it for bombs, and that's just a regular way of life. It's like you click the fob twice to unlock the car. I mean, it's just another thing that you do, and I just found that to be very powerful of that's the way of life.
Yeah, I mean, the IRA developed this bomb. They got the Semtex explosive from Gaddafi. Gaddafi sent four ships full of Semtex and weapons to the IRA in the early 80s, and they had all this massive amounts of Semtex plastic explosive, and they developed this device where you would put a block of Semtex under a car and you would attach it to a mercury tilt switch, and it could just sit under the car for months. And then eventually the policeman would have to get in his car and drive somewhere, and the mercury would be in this little vial, and eventually he'd come to a slope of a hill and the mercury would go down the vial, hit the contacts, hit the igniter, and then blow up the plastic explosive and kill the policeman. And they killed about 20 policemen this way. And so this memo went out that all policemen at all times, it was a very easy solution to fix it. All you had to do was look under your car, because you couldn't hide the big block of Semtex and the ignition device. So that just became a routine for every police officer and every army officer. I'll tell you a very quick story. I used to get a lift to school with a major in the British Army, and his son he was driving a car to the school with his son, and me and my little brother used to give a lift to him, get a lift from him. And he every morning he would go out and have to look under his car. So we were very aware of that. We would wait in the house while he looked under his car to see if there was a bomb under it that day. And if there wasn't a bomb, he would say, "Okay, lads, let's go." And we would drive off. And he would do that every single day, except the days when he didn't. And when it was raining or snowing, he couldn't be bothered. And he'd just say, "All right, forget about it, let's go." And I'd be driving to school, and our school was at the top of a gigantic hill. And at the bottom of the hill, I'd be looking at these idiots in the car with me, just my little brother and him and his son. I just go, "Oh my God, is this it? Is this where we all die and I have to die with these fools who don't even care about it?" And my little brother would be listening to his Walkman, and they'd be listening to, whatever music was on the radio. And I was the only one who was aware of this gigantic existential crisis that we were all about to have in the next 10 seconds. And of course, we were never killed, but still, I resented the hell out of them
Well,
for not caring.
that seems like the proper response. It's playing the odds, right? Like, well,
Yes.
it's raining. Oh, screw it. We'll just see what happens.
Yeah, exactly. They're playing the odds with my life. So yeah, that's a trope that I always wanted to have throughout the entire series.
You
And
met.
as you say earlier, I do love the trope. I just love it, of the detective on his last case. I love it when that's a movie idea, and it's just one more case, as Al Pacino says in The Godfather,
Right.
"Just when I thought I was out, they drag me back in." And I love that. I love that. All he has to do is get, and that one last case is going to be a nightmare. It's going to be a complete nightmare. And everybody knows, no matter how simple the boss describes that last case, it's going to be Sharon Stone with the ice pick, or Robert Duvall on Santa Monica Pier facing down Michael Douglas. It's going to be, one of those, that the last case is going to be a nightmare.
Bunny boiling on the stove.
Yes.
But there is that feeling throughout where the characters who have dismissed Sean for the most part, and yet there even seems to be an awareness that this could be something that's not going to be routine by any stretch of the imagination.
No, I wanted this to be a big one. I wanted this to be The Troubles have been going for 25 years, and the early 90s, especially 1992, was an incredibly significant year because that's when all the talk of peace going out. It's basically what we're having now with Russia and Ukraine. I mean, I recognize all these emotions and all these sort of ideas and secret negotiations were happening. And this was a very significant year because it was the year that basically most of the paramilitary organizations agreed to peace. And then the first ceasefire happened the next year in 1993. And then that was basically, it was very complicated, but that was basically an end to the Troubles. And we've had peace in Northern Ireland for 30 years now. So 1992 is a very, very significant year.
Do you see that as a solid piece or still very shaggy and somewhat fragmented piece?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, when you go back home, when I go back to Belfast and you go to certain areas, you still feel the undercurrents. And you still feel that this piece needs to be massaged and needed. I don't know if it is being taken care of that way, but it's still febrile. There's this atmosphere underneath it in Belfast to this very day. I'm not doing it, but I hope someone is keeping the communities informed and organized and safe. And I hope that's still going on because it's all still very much underneath the surface.
Adrian McKinty is our guest. The name of the new novel is Hang On, St. Christopher. It is a Sean Duffy novel. This character, obviously, like all of us, is imperfect, and yet there is such a thoughtfulness to his work as a detective. And I'm curious as to how you came to that and were able to pull that off in such a way of someone who's in that position and is really doing his job.
Yeah, I wanted to give him a rich cultural life, and I wanted the milieu to reflect the way Belfast and Ireland is. And culture runs deep there. Like everybody can play a musical instrument, everybody can recite a poem, everybody knows their history. It's a very literate culture, and I wanted to reflect that in the book. So I wanted there to be tons of music, tons of literature and tons of culture. And I wanted Duffy's life to reflect that as well. I find it quite boring if the detective doesn't read or doesn't listen to music or isn't interested in culture or, those violent detective novels and series where they just solve the case and that's all it is. And they don't seem to have an inner life or any interests, and you look at the bookshelf, especially on TV, when you look at the bookshelves, and the bookshelves have all been put in by the set designer, and they don't look like they're real books. And you look at the records, and again, it's or CDs, and they don't look real. Like they've never really thought, does this guy have a life? I was just watching The Shining a couple of months ago, and I don't know if you remember this, but in the Boulder apartment where Jack Nicholson and Shelley Duvall live, there is a brief look at a bookcase. And if you look, freeze the frame and look at the books in the bookcase, you know that Stanley Kubrick picked every single book to go in that bookcase because he knows what the characters are reading. And that's what I think is lacking in some novels and most TV shows is that they don't care. And I do care. So I want them to have the characters and especially Duffy to have a rich cultural milieu to play in.
I wrote this down as I was reading, and now I can't find it, but hopefully you remember it. But there's a line in the novel where you say, and I forget what the band and what the song is, but who would be playing that in 1992?
Oh, yes, the Sex Pistols.
The Sex Pistols, that's it.
Yeah. A guy's playing the Sex Pistols like 14 years after they came out. And yeah, that was a very enjoyable bit in the book because it's during the context of a fight. Duffy is critiquing his musical tastes. And it's during the context of a fist fight where Duffy is engaging him in his taste in music, which I very much enjoyed writing.
And this is, again, this is your sensibilities when you were growing up of what you were listening to, and then the sensibilities of this character of the time, which would be a different motif.
Yeah, I think I have better musical taste than Duffy. Duffy is very down on the 80s.
Yeah.
Because he's a child of the 60s and the 70s, and he thinks that like music peaked, I don't know, 68 to 75 or whatever those boomers think. Like if you ever read Rolling Stone, Rolling Stone is always repackaging 1965 to 1975 for us as if it's the greatest era in music. You know, they're selling the 60s back to the boomers in every single way they can. And that's how Rolling Stone has made money for the last 50 years. And, you know, that's why they invented the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and all that stuff to put their 60s heroes into it. And I appreciate the 60s and I love the 60s. And there's no bigger Led Zeppelin or Who or Yardbirds fan or Rolling Stones or Beatles fan than me. But I'm a child of the 80s, man. And Duffy hates the 80s. I thought that would be quite fun. Where he's,
yes,
the music blaring from the radio is torturing him. Just, but I love the 80s.
He just dismisses it.
Yeah, I love the Smiths and New Order. And Duffy hates U2, and it drives him crazy when Bono's on the road, which I also love because there's a lot of Irish people who hate Bono or Bono or however he just calls himself. And but I'm not him. I love the Smiths. And Duffy, the Smiths, Morrissey drives Duffy insane. And I can see how Morrissey drives people insane. And I enjoy driving him insane with Morrissey. But I am actually a fan.
So let me ask you a somewhat serious question, but not really, which is, what is the impact, do you think, on you of living through that time? You're obviously writing about it. You're still thinking about it. Of that, is there a trauma that is overcome, or is it just a way of life that you try to figure out, or maybe even that you can't believe that anyone survived it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's about 500,000 people living in Northern Ireland with PTSD that is undiagnosed because we went through some crazy stuff that we don't even realize that we went through. You know, just bombings and riots and this low-level civil war, like buses would be bombed that you'd be in, or trains would be bombed, or, you know, just stuff that we children shouldn't have had to go through. Like I remember just one time I found a bullet in the street. And to get into the center of Belfast, you had to go through these things called the search huts, because there were so many bombings. They actually they put up a perimeter around Belfast and they searched civilians going into the search huts so that they couldn't carry bombs and their people could shop in the center of Belfast. And those were up for like 15, 20 years until the peace process came. And now there's no trace of them. People like don't even know that they were there, but they were a thing that you had to do. And I remember one time my little brother and I found a bullet in the street and we decided to put it in my sister's handbag so that when she went through the search hut, she'd be arrested. We as little children, we thought this would be a tremendous joke.
Very funny.
But it was not a joke.
Yeah.
She got in enormous amounts of trouble because she said, I've never seen that before in my life. And they would say, what? You've never seen a bullet in your handbag before? Like, what are you doing with... And oh my God, the trouble me and my little brother got into, although he blamed me, of course, just that kind of stuff happened once a week. And I'm sorry I didn't write it all down because at the time, well, I never thought about it because I just thought that was normal life. And it wasn't until I went to university in England when I realized that was not normal. That was like there weren't bombings and riots every night and you didn't have to get searched to go into a store and, you know, there just wasn't a war on. And, you know, when I would come back from university at Christmas back into that world again, I think, wow, this is crazy. This is like Doctor Who going to a new planet. You know, it was bizarre. And so I think you're absolutely right. I think there's maybe 500,000 people walking around with undiagnosed PTSD.
I just, these books are, to me, are towering. They're so fun and great and just so well written and told.
Tell your friends. Yes.
an
Tell
express.
everybody.
Well, I hope people listening to this will especially, but not even mystery fans, just people who like a really, really good story. And it's and you don't have to read them in any order, by the way. I did not. I read them out of order, and it doesn't matter, I don't think.
Oh, it doesn't. Well, I only ever write standalones because, you know, it's so often you'll go to like a bed and breakfast or an Airbnb, and it'll be rainy and your plans will have changed, and you go, well, I'll just sit inside and look at some books from their book collection, and you find like book six of a series and you just go, what?
Yeah,
like I can't read this. Or it's volume two, you just go, well, where's volume one? I remember that exact thing happened to me with that, you know, the Golden Compass books.
Oh sure. Yeah.
So I found book two. And you can't really read book two without having read book one. And I was completely confused. And so I thought, I vowed that I would never do that. All my books would have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And you can read them completely out of order. You know, it doesn't matter.
I think I started with Rain Dogs, and it may still be my favorite.
That was such a fun one to do because that begins with a completely fictional experience of Muhammad Ali coming to Belfast. And I enjoyed that so much, that beginning. It's a shaggy dog story. It doesn't go anywhere, but I enjoyed writing it so much.
It is a real treat to talk to you, Adrian. I can't tell you how much I enjoy your work and the new novel in the Sean Duffy series is Hang On St. Christopher, and it's just terrific, absolutely wonderful, so entertaining, and just escapism at its absolute best. Adrian McKinty's book is Hang On St. Christopher. It is published by Blackstone, and I thank you so much for being with us. It's a great pleasure to have you here.
It was a joy to talk to you, and thank you so much for having me.
I really appreciate it. Thank you. Again, Adrian McKinty's new novel is Hang On, St. Christopher, published by Blackstone Publishing. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LeDuc. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week. Thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.